everyone, and welcome to 1010 Would Recommend, the podcast hosted by me, Talani.
And me, Gina.
We are here every week telling you about the shows to watch on Netflix and on the television sphere itself.
In today's episode, we'll be talking about the documentary Nail Bomber Manhunt, which tells the story of how one man held London to ransom for 13 days in 1999. Our guests are Daniel Vernon, who is the director of the documentary, and Mike Franklin, one of the people intrinsic to the capture of David Copeland.
Gina, this second season has been back for a couple of episodes now, and we haven't talked about Firefly Lane. And we both watched that at the same time and both really, really enjoyed it. And I just feel like, why have we not spoke about it?
I'm a goddamn legend in the making.
That's right, you are.
You don't get it. You don't know what it's like to fail, and you succeed at everything you try.
It's like this is your life and I'm just along for the ride.
You are so much braver than me. Your family, that is the real accomplishment. I will never have that. I was too scared to even try.
They need you. You're my soulmate, you bitch.
I know. This is the thing, is that during our brief hiatus, I say brief.
it's been 68 years.
There were a bunch of shows that we didn't get to recommend in that time. And one of them 100% is Firefly Lane. That was... So good.
It's based on a friendship, I guess, and it goes through their different decades through their lives of these two best friends. And it ends on such a cliffhanger. And I haven't seen a cliffhanger like that since EastEnders. Like, no one does cliffhangers anymore.
Yeah, it was
you
really,
kind of get
really
a resolution
good.
Now. Yeah, but it really ends on a massive cliffhanger and it takes you on a journey. And I naturally like friendship shows anyway.
I also like love the trope of female friendships or any kind of friendship where one of the, like, they're complete opposites, but somehow it still works. Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that.
And there's always one that needs saving.
Yeah.
And like Tully or Tully. Was it Tully? Tully.
I think it's Tully, but it sounds Tully. Like Tully.
It does sound like Tully, yeah. That confused me watching. I kept looking back, but no, not you, baby. but I really, really, I love that. I really, really love that series. And it goes through, what years does it go through again? The 80s at some point? Because the fashion is...
Yeah, so one of them is like the 80s. One of them is like the, I want to say noughties, but that might be wrong. And then I think one is the present day around
the... in the 2000s, because they talk about the Iraq War.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of fashion, the 80s fashion in it, Halston.
That's a good one. We both just started watching that.
I watched the first episode and I was like, oh, I really like this.
I've been an outsider my whole life. Till one day I just stopped giving a flying fuck.
My wife, she thinks you're a genius. I think that's a dangerous word. I think what you call yourself a genius, you stop growing.
Halston for your today. Halston for your everyday. It's really, really good. I was saying earlier, it gives me very much, if anybody's seen The Assassination of Gianni Versace, it's just the look and feel of that show is very much similar. They're both about fashion, obviously, but just the look of it is very, it's crisp. I don't know how to explain it. It's just very...
Fashion shows do that. They do that really, like the colouring is really crisp and you can, it's vibrant.
Yeah.
Like it feels like, okay, this makes sense of the world it's in. And I'm going to say her name wrong, but Liza Minnelli, isn't it? Have I said that right?
Liza Minnelli.
Liza Minnelli. And that's a good point because she does a whole song. Well, the character that plays her does a whole song on how to pronounce her name.
Yeah.
And I kept rewinding it because I really enjoyed the song. But yeah, I am saying her name wrong. But it was just so good. It was such good vibes. And I feel like it's going to get like really interesting really quickly.
Yeah.
The sex scene at the start, I was like, oh, that's quick.
I know.
I think it was like the first 10 minutes. I was like, okay.
I was literally watching it at 10 in the morning and my window was open in my living room. And I was like, oh my goodness.
Why are sex scenes uncomfortable earlier in the day?
It feels wrong. It feels really naughty. I just felt like if anybody walks past my window, they're going to be like, why is she watching a full-on sex scene at 10 in the morning and not having a coffee like everyone else?
Why is sex scenes, sex, limited to nighttime?
Why can't
you watch a sex scene at 10 a.m. in the morning?
Because sex is like taboo, isn't it? So you have to hide it in the nighttime and meh. But like, you know, right? It must be that.
I don't know. I feel like I'm going to do a campaign for us to watch sex scenes whenever.
I'm sure many people do.
Of all the campaigns to pick in the world, that's the fight I want to fight.
Definitely watch Firefly Lane. Definitely watch Halston. But let's talk a little bit, T, about, because I think this episode is going to be quite deep.
Mm-hmm.
Because the topic of the documentary that we're talking about today, and today's episode, is about Nell Bomber Manhunt.
Yes.
It's deep. It is really, really deep.
I cried watching it.
It was just so... There's something about watching a documentary about a topic like that, but also when it's so poignant to today, that definitely just like hits you. Do you know what I mean?
That's the thing, because it happened in 1999, but everything that was being said, I was like, that could be 2021.
Exactly.
Like, none of these things are so far reaching. It's like, oh, it happened in the olden days, so that's why. And also, I was really surprised by how I'd never heard about it.
Me too.
Like, 1999 is pretty recent, but I'd mm-hmm. never heard about it at all. And the fact that it was so London-centric and it affected people like me, basically. Mm-hmm. But yeah, never heard a word about it ever.
Totally agree. And for those of you that are confused, Nell Bomber Manhunt tells the story of how one man held London to ransom for 13 days in 1999. And essentially, it was a far-right extremist that detonated these three bombs in three different areas within South London. And it talks about that story and talks to survivors and archives. This was a topic that obviously touched Talani and I a lot. So we're really excited to have this discussion. But before we do, let's have a listen to the trailer.
It was a beautiful morning. Everybody was everywhere. All of a sudden,
police walked over. I went, that's a bomb.
Did you think of the consequences?
It was my destiny.
It was just complete shock and helplessness.
This was like a war scene.
Detectives fear the bomb could be the start of a terror campaign.
I thought it was a racist threat.
Was it a group of people? Was it one person?
There was lots of speculation. And then...
The second weekend running in the capital, ethnic communities have once again been targeted.
This strikes at the heart of the Bengali community.
We will defeat the people who are responsible for these bombs.
So Mike and Daniel, thank you guys so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Gina and I have been anxious about this. We think it's really important to talk about this documentary. And I think the first thing we both notice is that we've never heard of it. Gina is from South London herself. I was born in London, and it's 1999, a year where I was definitely old enough to be watching the news and being aware of what was happening. And I had never, ever heard anything about the Nell Bomber. I'd never heard about any of the attacks. So it was shocking to hear it for the first time in 2021.
Yeah, so when I came to the story, I was really surprised, actually, that I didn't know more about this. I wasn't living in London at the time, but the news I remember was, it was about the Soho bombing. And it was only fairly recently doing research into this that, of course, you know, this was an attack across London, and it was an attack on all sorts of communities. And so, to be honest, it was sort of the origins of the making of this was to tell a story that actually I think people have forgotten. And certainly there's a generation, a younger generation of people who've never heard any of it. So yeah, it came to a surprise to quite a lot of people that this even happened, even people living in London themselves.
I actually wanted to pick up on that point, because I think it's a really interesting, I guess, issue of how intersectional politics plays out in the way that stories are covered. Because, you know, it was fascinating to me that this had happened in three minority communities, essentially. But the one of the three got the sort of more press recognition, essentially. And that's the one that a lot more people sort of knew of. Mike, for you, as somebody who was a part of the Brixton community, which was one of the places where this bombing took place, had you noticed that sort of difference in the press covering at the time?
I mean, first of all, you've got to remember the context, not just the incident, but the context of the incident. The Brixton bombing happened less than 2 months after the publication of the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry report. So there was a lot of attention on the police, the black community, crime and hate crime. And the fact that when the Brixton bomb happened on that Saturday, and there was a big expectation about how the Met Police would respond to this horrendous hate crime, the first knockings of commentary in the media were that we have no evidence that this is a race hate crime, although we in the community were convinced that it was. The following week, it was Brick Lane, which was the Bangladeshi community. And while I was talking to the investigation team and the counterterrorism teams and all the people that were involved in the investigation, we were trying to think about where the bomber would strike next. And we looked at things like Swiss Cottage. We looked at the parts of the Jewish community, the community in Southall. And we were trying to make sure that those communities were forewarned, because we were convinced that there was a serial hater bomber on the loose. So given that the context was just after the publication of the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry Report, there was a degree of crisis of confidence. The Met Police had just been branded institutionally racist by the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry Report, and that's why it was so significant. And the reason we knew it was a hater was because the climate had been raised by the publication of the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry Report. And we were really, really concerned that because the bomber was unsuccessful in killing anybody in Brixton, that they would come back. So a lot of our work with trying to generate public confidence in the police investigation, trying to give the police ideas about lines of inquiry, trying to get them to properly communicate with a community that had been, I think, really affected by the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, that was one of the challenges.
No, absolutely. I think sometimes even the idea of just calling this person a hater doesn't even feel strong enough for what they've done. I mean, the documentary goes into how, like, these communities, there was a mention of the BNP, and instantly I was triggered. As soon as I heard it, like, I felt my body, like, literally stiffen up, because I grew up in Dagenham, and there was a point where BNP, like, literally ruled Dagenham. And I, as a young Black girl, would get leaflets through my door being like, stop the ethnic minorities, or like, stop them at any cause, which instantly made me realise that my body as a Black body wasn't safe. And I can only imagine after going through that, and as a community, being aware that you're not safe, but still coming together to be like, we have to fight this thing. And again, what made me emotional was that the lack of, I guess, support that was felt by the Black community, by the police, is something that still echoes today in 2021. We can still be like, we're reporting things, we're talking about things, and things are being ignored. And it still feels like a fight for the community that is not interested by the police, sort of thing. And it's always interesting when crimes happen for people that are considered minorities, and how it seemingly to the public enemy feels like it takes longer than any other crimes to kind of sort out and deal with, sort of thing. And it was such a waste of lives, because it shouldn't have gone past the first thing. Like, nobody should have ever died by this man's hands.
Again, I was talking about the context, because we'd had the all the publicity around the Stephen Lawrence inquiry up until the report was published in February 1999. So, you know, there were a lot of, we were very active in the community anyway. It wasn't just this that brought us into this environment where we were talking to the police about solving crime in our community. You know, we were still trying to stop knife crime. 2 years earlier, we'd had the first ever local guns amnesty in British history in Brixton. So we knew that we could do things to keep our community safe. One of the problems with this was the concern, I guess, that the police had about admitting that this was probably a race hate crime, and the possible consequences of that in terms of community confidence, given that the police had been branded institutionally racist in a public inquiry report 2 months earlier. So one of the things that we were trying to do was and particularly myself as the chair of the police consultative group in Lambeth at the time, I was trying to make sure that the investigation focused on not just the actual issue around the crime, but about the lack of confidence that the community had in the police, and it was for the police to pull their fingers out and make sure they caught this bomber.
Let's talk about the footage for a moment, because there was a ton of archival footage for this documentary. And Daniel, as a documentary maker, that must have been a dream to have all of that archive stuff, all of the interview stuff available. How did you go about piecing together, Daniel, all of that footage and getting your interviews and building this so that you could do the story justice?
I mean, surprisingly, there wasn't a huge amount of footage. I mean, these days, if an event like this happened now, you would have unlimited resource, especially people filming on their phones of the event themselves. This was kind of just precursor to 24-hour rolling news. So it was also the time where you had Sky News, you know, suddenly came out of nowhere and they came down with cameras and filmed the aftermath of Brixton, where remarkably they happened to, and we only found this a few weeks before the end of the edit, we managed to find, you know, the two Barrow boys at the beginning with, you know, the ripped up jeans, there they were suddenly walking towards the camera, which was quite remarkable. And so you got a sense of how it, you know, you never get a sense of how it really was at the time, but you were able to see the carnage, some of the carnage that was left over there. And the same with the Soho bombing, actually. It happened to be a guy who was photographing in Berwick Street Market some asparagus. So at the beginning of his roll of film, there's pictures of close-ups of asparagus and oranges. And then he heard the explosion. He ran down there, and the rest of the photos are of, you know, absolute horror. So, yeah, in terms of the archive, it was trying to piece together from lots of different sources how to try and build the story together. Now, the one piece of archive which acted as a bit of a thread through it was the BNP footage. And I was really surprised at how much these guys pushed themselves forwards and, in the sort of, with respectable suits in front of the Houses of Parliament, and yet there was hate speech. And that was really shocking to see how far that was being allowed to even be broadcast at the time. And I think going back to what you said at the beginning of this is, why don't we remember this? I think part of the reason is because when this story came out, eventually, after people like Mike banged on the door and said, this is a racist attack, eventually the Met had to say, yeah, it was kind of racist. But what they did do was say that this was an act of a loner, a one-off, probably won't happen again. What they failed to do is to understand that this was the result of a much bigger organisation that has just kept on growing and morphed in much more secretive ways. They don't stand in front of the House of Parliament now. You know, they're not like John Tyndall. They're actually finding much more sophisticated ways of tapping into young minds, and the situation is very different now. So I think that's one of the reasons it's one of these stories that's slightly covered up, because actually the conclusion was it's the act of a madman, act of a loner. Yes, he was racist, but he was doing it on his own. He wasn't. He was supported. There's a whole architecture, you know, there's a whole system around him that needs further investigation.
Yeah, because it's such a complex and padded story. And yes, it is this one sole person, but like you said, he's backed by so many ideologies as well. So was there any desire to talk to him? I mean, I know we get a lot of that in recent in documentaries where people want to talk to the actual person that does it. Was there ever a desire to do that at all? Or did you just not want him in it at all?
We made a very conscious decision about this from the beginning, that actually here was somebody who wanted to be famous. Here was somebody who wanted to be heard, and the way he did that was to commit these atrocities. So we wanted to make sure that we never stepped over the line and gave him that kind of soapbox and to give an interview, because really, what would he tell us? He doesn't sound redemptive from what I've heard. So it would just give him a further platform. So we contacted the family just to let them know what we were doing out of respect, but we didn't. You know, we didn't want to speak to him. No, even if we could, we wouldn't have done.
I wanted to pick up on your point, actually, about that wider architecture at play that allows for these sort of views by the person who did it, but the wider group of the BNP and that sort of hate speech to be propelled. Because for me, I could not get over the person who was undercover in the group and the question being asked, like, did you ever start to believe what was being told to you, and him sort of honestly answer. And I honestly, you know, I'm glad that he was honest. It was scary, but he was honestly like, yeah, after a while I did feel as if, yeah, maybe this is true. Maybe I'm believing all the things that I believe are wrong. And actually this is the truth about that. I don't know. I really wanted to sort of ask you about your thoughts about sort of his part in the documentary and what it was like speaking to him and his, And what is a really unique, I guess, part in this whole story?
Yeah, I mean, Arthur is, and he's unique, period, because he literally walked off the street and, the BNP had been campaigning in an area he lived in, and he wanted to do something about it. And what was, there were so many fascinating things about him, but essentially you've got two men about the same age. One of them decides that he wants to plant bombs and kill people, and another person decides that he wants to stop people, like, you know, he wants to be on the completely opposing side to that. And they cross lines. They both walk into the... So Arthur joined the BNP before Copeland did, but they happened to cross over each other, and they were both there for completely different purposes. Arthur had, you know, he'd never done anything like that before, and when he entered Searchlight, it wasn't like they could give him loads of training. He was on the ground trying to work out how to become a spy, not be caught, and it still blows my mind a bit, because he never took any money for it. He didn't write a book about it. You know, there's none of this sort of usual cashing in. It was a purely selfless act that was just really unusual and rare. But yeah, he was an integral part of the story, without a doubt.
Yeah, I thought he was really interesting, because there was a part when they mentioned that even his family didn't know what he was doing until like the 20th anniversary of the bombing, and just how, yeah, I think the role he played was very interesting, just to see again the contrasting parts of two people who both joined this party, I guess, because he went in there completely opposed to it. And then he was like, there was a point when he thought, actually, are these people making a point? Which is actually quite interesting and scary.
I suppose, day after day, I mean, it's sort of pre-internet in the way we know it now, but day after day, he's hanging around with these people for 10 years, you know, he's being slapped, and some of them became his friends. There's no other way of doing this spy thing properly, I guess. So day after day, you're being told by people that, you can see good sides to, and they're telling you this crap as well. And then eventually, it's hard to see, but it did obviously get, it went that far with him. But in a way, Arthur represents, I mean, what I think is most interesting about this story in some ways is it's, Arthur is a bit, there's so many ordinary people in this story. Mike's one of them. I don't mean to call you ordinary, Mike, but you're a normal guy who just decided to do something very brave and stand up against a lot of opposition. And I think that's what's quite incredible, because the police, you know, they didn't really have a clue, did they? And I think they were trying to do what they could, but it was actually the people that caught the bomber essentially weren't the police. Physically, the police grabbed him, yes, but it was the likes of Arthur, the likes of Mike, the likes of a number of other people involved in this story who brought him to justice. And I think that's what gives you that, it does give you a sense of hope that these things can be done, but also a sense, it's quite scary, because how often do people really stand up against this? I don't know.
It also gives you a sense of the failure of Copeland, because the narrative that we adopted after the investigation, when he was finally arrested and convicted, was that this was a person who was a hater, and he attempted to kill and maim people, black people in Brixton, Asian Bangladeshi people in Brick Lane, and the gay people in Soho. This was a complete and utter failure. And I guess one of the strong points about the documentary is the transcripts from his interviews, where he's actually asked about his motivation, about his intention. And we knew when Copeland was captured that he would have carried on bombing until he was caught. And we knew we also knew that ultimately one of his targets was the Notting Hill Carnival. You can imagine a bomb packed with nails going off in the middle of a crowd at Notting Hill Carnival. So we didn't underestimate how serious this was. And I guess one of the concerns that the police had was the community reaction. Because, as I say again, 2 months after the publication of the Stephen Lawrence report, that was one of the things that drove a lot of us to try and hold up a mirror to some of those failures of the past. This was a serious one. They really, really had to get on top of this. And I think on the way, we had to make sure we told people what it felt like to be in a community that where you were thinking, if I go shopping in Brixton Market this Saturday, am I going to get bombed? That was what a lot of people were saying on the streets. People were really, really concerned. And then you start looking at people, wondering who the bomber might be, who might be involved, and so on. But I was saying before, Gina, about the importance of the CCTV and the fact that the cameras were elevated cameras looking downwards. So you didn't have, you know, the full body pictures of people. You had the heads and shoulders in a big milling crowd. So the firstly, I pay tribute to the police for rapidly scrutinising that CCTV and coming up with a potential suspect. The issue that was then, how quickly were they going to release a picture of Copeland so that anybody who might know him or might have known him would be able to come forward? And I felt that there was some prevarication over releasing that picture quickly. And their reason was that if we release this, it's a blurry picture, we're going to get inundated with tens of thousands of calls and it will cripple the helpline and so on and so forth. But my response to that every time was, while you're prevaricating over this grainy picture, the bomber is preparing the next bomb. And that was the issue. What are you going to say to us if you're here having this discussion about the picture and another bomb goes off? And, you know, sometimes it's about that reality check. You've got to be able to put that reality in front of them and make them see the urgency. And you'd had people saying, you know, we want to catch him as much as you do, Mike. I said, no, you don't. You don't live in Brixton.
Yeah, definitely. That was mentioned in the documentary, actually, where someone, the community was talking about the aggravation with some of the replies they got from the police. And Mike, you made a good point about the recordings and getting your hands on the interview. Daniel, how did you manage that? Is it like public domain? Can anybody get it? How did you get the recording of him kind of saying his motives?
Oh, it's a very exhaustive process. I mean, the thing is about him, and he really should have been advised to do it by a lawyer, is you no comment, and most people these days, no comment. This guy just talked and talked and talked for days and days and days. And he did believe that he was politically motivated. But what's interesting in the interviews is the further you go down into it, you start unpeeling a very vulnerable character who was unsure about a lot of things. And obviously somebody who, you know, when he was in the clutches of the BNP, just poured all of the angst and hatred he had as a young man into these ridiculous ideas that are being touted by Tyndall and the likes. So he was sort of an empty vessel, just a nobody, who, you know, you join these organisations and they just fill that vessel with reasons why you should hate more. You're one of us. They are essentially a family that he, you know, was looking for. And, you know, we go back to Arthur, and Arthur obviously had a family and had friends before he declared himself a Nazi to everyone, and everyone probably gave him a white berth. But he too, he shows the power of that kind of psychological brainwashing, really, that someone like Arthur, who was there strictly to do something good, he was going there to oppose them, but even he felt changed by it day after day after day after day after day. Drinking with these people, sharing time with these people, getting to know, you know, their family, their friends, their kids. And you start seeing a different reality. And I think that's really frightening. And at no stage, really, in those interviews, I didn't think, was he being questioned enough about these organisations and what he was in? Because really, you'd expect after an event like that to, you know, to go after others. And I'm not quite sure they did. Because there's more people culpable, definitely.
I'm curious, Daniel, having made the doc and been the director, and Mike, having seen the doc and also been a part of it, for both of you, and Daniel, I'll take your answer first. What is, for you, the most crucial scene in the documentary?
There are a few that every time I hear them, they still, stay with me. One of them, it's actually the ending. It's actually Mike, which, to be honest, if it was anyone else but Mike and what he's been through, saying there's more good than bad, it would sound like a cliche. But after that story and it being Mike involved in it, he owns those words and they mean it. That actually that's the ray of hope that you take away, that remember that the film is actually about the people that stopped this bomber. Who ultimately failed, and humanity won over, courage, bravery won over. And I feel that is the biggest, strongest message I take from it. But I guess also I always think about Gary, who lost his leg. I think it's his sort of philosophy about it all at the end, and how he reminds us that this is something where the ripples go so much further. I think it's his dignity is what it is, to recognise that he hasn't just taken away something from himself, from Gary. He's taken something away from hundreds of other people connected. It's like the ripple effect of all these people who are, if they're not physically damaged, they're psychologically damaged. And then he goes back to Copeland himself saying his life, what a waste of a life. What an absolute waste of to his parents and everything. And I think just being able to have that overview and have that insight from someone who lived through it is, again, I found it quite important.
That was the same thing for me as well. I wrote it down and he was like, what a waste of lives. Like, what was the point of this? So many people's lives have been affected, included his own. And that bit really touched me as well at the end of the documentary, definitely.
Well, Daniel, I remember when we were doing the filming, one of the things that I remember saying was that I was left with the same feeling about waste, about missed opportunity, about the impact of evil, you know, how wickedness can ruin people's lives. I watched the documentary with my grandson. That's a bit at the end. We're talking about, you know, more good people than bad was the thing that resonated with him most. But I remember when we were filming, saying, well, you know, Copeland's doing 6 life sentences in prison. I'm going home. It's Friday evening and enjoy myself. And it's that feeling of, in spite of the unspeakable evil, you know, good people prevailed, the rule of law prevailed, and we learned something. We learned something about ourselves, about our community's strengths and resilience. We learned something about the about how people fight back against wickedness, and we learned something about how important it is to challenge and defeat racism in all its forms. Because what Copeland was the sharp end of hate, the sharp end of discrimination, hate, and just, you know, racism. And yet he failed. For all that, he failed. Okay, he injured many people, maimed people, killed people. But the intention of creating a race war didn't work. There were black people and white people and Asian people and straight people and gay and lesbian people, all after catching this man, and we succeeded. And the hope that I'm left with is that like our two friends here today, who said they weren't aware of it, but having heard about it, that you take that, you know, take that with you for your future. The fact is, we don't have to live in that type of cesspit of hatred, and the damage that it does for people, it's really, really worth rolling up your sleeves and fighting against it. And I'm quite proud of the role that I played in catching this man. And I'm quite proud of the role that the community of Brixton played.
Well, we are very proud of you, Mike, and everything that you've done and are doing. And I think that literally your last speech actually filled a power in me to be like, because sometimes it does get down and dear you. It does feel like we're still having these same conversations. There's still homophobia, there's still racism, there's still all these things. But then I think in a world where there is very good now, there's also very bad. I'm very happy that many a times the very good like wins, and it's really, really nice to see that. And Daniel, thank you for making this documentary, not only to educate everybody else, but also myself, who didn't have a clue about this. And I'm going to shout about it. Like, everybody needs to watch it and just be informed about it, for sure.
I spent 10 years undercover in the far right. I've got a different perspective. There was talk about starting a race war. All someone had to do was light a match.
Whilst the politicians and the police were dithering,
the bomber is preparing the next bomb.
It brought the pressure to a different level.
Nobody was thinking about the fact that this could go wider to the gay community.
I was passing by, and then...
I feel like weirdly empowered by that. I guess not weirdly, but I feel massively empowered by that. And honestly, guys, please watch the Nail Bomber Manhunt. It's very interesting. And yeah, I think it's really insightful. The way documentary has been done, the interviews, just talking to the ordinary people that play such a big part in this massive manhunt. It's amazing. Definitely watch it. Definitely worth watching, I'd say. 10/10 would recommend.
And, you know, I really feel like, you know, that That bit about good prevailing over evil was so poignant to me, because what you were saying about it feeling really dreary is so true. Like, it made me think, where do I get the nerve to be so pessimistic constantly? Like, I need to, for the good of everyone, like, everyone needs to, for the good of the world, be, like, optimistic.
You know what it is? It's because so often you don't see good winning. It feels like good is not winning, even though it does feel like good is not winning. It so often feels like the news is always bad. So it's just like, when does good win, sort of thing? So it's actually good to hear a story where it does win. And it's like, yeah, it's like history teaching us lessons and history telling us that as a community, we can really shake up the world, which is great to know.
Absolutely, we can. Definitely. So yes, as T says, we both, 10 out of 10, would recommend that documentary. But if you want to watch something a little more lighthearted, we do have some other recommendations. We already mentioned Halston. That is really, really great. We'll give the bare premise of this is that it's about a fashion designer who starts, I think, by making hats for his mum.
Yeah, he starts by making hats and then everybody stops wearing hats. Yeah. Although I do love a hat. Do you know, I've never seen you in a hat.
That's because I have a huge head.
I'm sorry. Hats look great on me. but he's like... They do. I've got a good head for hats, but he is like a massive New York legend. He's like mates with Andy Warhol. Like he's a big time man in the fashion world. So it's really interesting to see this story and see how it plays out.
Yeah.
And just, I guess, I feel like I'm learning about new people all the time.
Me again, too.
I don't think I'd ever heard of him before this. What else would you recommend watching? Anything else as a 10-10 this week?
Well, I would say if you're looking for a thriller, look, we all know now that I'm a scaredy pants. But if you like thrillers, then you should definitely watch Woman in the Window. It stars Amy Adams and Gary Oldman, premise of which is a woman who, from her window, sees a murder.
911.
My neighbor Jane, she's been stabbed.
NYPD.
Why is he here?
Mr. Russell believes that you made a mistake.
You have never met my wife.
We spent the evening together.
I'm Jane Russell.
She's not Jane. I know what I saw.
Your doctor said that your meds can cause hallucinations.
Why are you protecting them?
Oh, no. Did you spoil anything there?
I don't think I did. Someone gets stabbed.
Like, you just keep revealing more when you don't need to. You could have just been like, she sees a bad thing happen.
She sees a spooky thing happen.
Yes. And then that's the story follows on from there.
Correct.
I haven't started watching it yet, but I've heard amazing things about Startup.
Yeah, it got recommended to me the other day.
Yeah, it's not a recommendation for me. So if you don't like it, don't at me. but I'll watch it and I'll let you know more next week.
And speaking of adding, please do at us in your recommendations using the hashtag 1010 would recommend, as always. And T, if they want to just talk to you, say lovely things, where can they find you on socials?
You can only send me lovely things at Tolly_T on Instagram and Tolly_T on Twitter.
And you can send me equally as lovely things at SmileGena, that's G-E-N-A, on Instagram, Twitter and TikTok. And if you want to look for Netflix UK elsewhere, it's Netflix UK on all platforms, including YouTube.
That is it for this week's 1010 would recommend. Thank you guys so much for listening. Like Gina said, please be sure to use the hashtag 1010 would recommend and chat to you guys next week. Bye from me.
Bye.